Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 496. My name is Camden Busey. I serve as the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be back with you today. We have with us Jim Cassidy, who is the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's always great to speak with you.
It's really good to be here, and we are climbing very close to that 500 number, aren't we?
Dangerously close. I hope we're not like Icarus and something really bad's going to happen to us when we hit that number. We've got to figure out what we're going to do, but hopefully we'll have a celebration episode coming up, just four more for episode 500. It's a big deal.
I think of it more as like hitting that 500th career home run, you know, kind of a celebratory kind of thing.
But I don't think we've hit any of them on performance-enhancing drugs, so hopefully there won't be any asterisks.
Well, there was
that
one episode when... No, never mind.
Maybe for you. You Mets fan and all, but yeah. Well, I'm the one with the Sammy Sosa history over here, but anyway. A little bit off the mark here, but we're excited. Approaching 500. We've had a lot of special episodes, and we're very excited to keep marching forward. And today we have a friend of ours. He's been on the program several times before. Today we're welcoming Dr. Brandon Crow to the program. Welcome, Brandon. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's great to be back with you.
Brandon serves as Associate Professor of New Testament at Westminster Theological Seminary, and he's the author of many articles and several books. Today we're going to be speaking about an article he wrote in the Westminster Theological Journal, Fulfillment in Matthew as Eschatological Reversal. This was in Volume 75, back in 2013. It's on pages 111 through 127 for those of you with database access. You want to go download the full text PDF, it's all there. Or for those of you who already have the copy from back in 2013, this is an important topic, and we're going to open this up and speak about it today. But before we do so, just got a few things to mention. First is that Christ the Center, of course, is listener-supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and viewers to help us produce and distribute all of these programs free of charge. So we encourage you to visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. There you can pledge your support. You can do a one-time gift, a monthly gift of any amount. So we put a challenge out there. Still looking for some 1689 gifts. If anybody out there is interested in donating $16.89 to pledge your vote or cast your vote for the London Baptist Confession, we encourage you to send those in. So we're still looking for the first one. So all you London guys out there, I'm wondering, you know, what's going on? But we're here and we're waiting. We got a few 1936s, some 1517s, and some other interesting dates. So just a little gimmick to try to get you to help us out. We thank everyone for listening and supporting us here at Reformed Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. That brings me to mention that we have some big news, as I've mentioned in the feed already, and some of you who subscribe to the general Reformed Forum podcast feed, you may notice already that we have welcomed now to our network of podcasts our good friends at Theology Simply Profound, Bob Tarullo and Rob McKenzie down at Westminster OPC in Indian Head Park, Illinois, have been recording that program. They're on episode 78. Now they're recently just been discussing deacons in Acts or proto-deacons. And there's just a wonderful wealth of informative topics there. They're really filling a gap for us here at Reformed Forum by talking about our confessional standards and the Reformed tradition that we love so dearly, but seeking to do so in a more accessible way. Here at Christ the Center, of course, we kind of go deep and we talk about some obscure stuff, and we love that, but it's not the only thing we want to do at Reformed Forum. So check out Theology Simply Profound and tell your friends and family all about it. You can subscribe to it online at reformedforum.org. One final thing, book your calendars for the Reformed Forum Conference in October. We're looking at October 6th, 7th, and 8th. That's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Of course, that Sunday is a worship service, so if you can't stay for the Sunday, you can certainly come for the Friday night and the Saturday, October 6th and 7th, 2017. We're welcoming the conference again, hoping to have it here at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, It's been a running tradition, and we're really excited about it. We're just about ready to finalize the topic. I know we're really behind the ball on this. We want to get the date there for you, but we're looking at doing some really neat stuff on the Reformation and how that interacts very closely with some of our Reformed heroes, some of the guys we write about so many times here at Reformed Forum. So all of that's available. Information's online, reformedforum.org. If you got any questions, email us at mail@reformedforum.org. Well, thanks, brothers, for joining me today. We're excited to have you both. And Brandon, we're really looking forward to discussing this article, Fulfillment in Matthew as Eschatological Reversal. I just started a series in Matthew, and just a couple weeks ago, just preached the end of Matthew 2 there, which is kind of well known for being a difficult passage. At least the basic idea is very simple. But difficult in terms of trying to figure out exactly what Matthew is doing with his Old Testament references. Could you just introduce to the listeners a little bit of the history of Matthean interpretation? Why are these fulfillment formulas in Matthew so perplexing to so many people?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And let me just start out also by saying, I think it's if your listeners don't have access to the Westminster Journal, this particular essay is online.
Oh, great.
At the Westminster faculty site.
Oh, and we'll link to that. Yeah, I'm looking at that right now. You can find that at faculty.wts.edu, and you can look through the different faculty members, and Brandon's profile here is available. Yeah, you've got several things here. Okay, thanks for letting me know that. I'll put a link to that in the episode description.
Yeah, so to your question about fulfillment in Matthew, it's an important question, because Matthew has a clear interest in the way that Jesus fulfills the Old Testament, and he uses the language of fulfillment quite a lot. And what has attracted the attention of scholars for many years are these uniquely Matthean formula quotations, fulfillment formula quotations. That is, they are uniquely Matthean because they are not in any of the other Gospels, and they are explicit in the way they say this was done in order to fulfill what was written in the prophet or the prophets, and that one at the end of Matthew 2 that you mentioned, he will be called a Nazarene, I assume is the one you're talking about. That simply says the prophets, and people try to figure out where does that come from. But that's what Matthew is doing with these. He is showing that Jesus is fulfilling the Old Testament. They are unique to Matthew. And they give an explicit quotation to the Old Testament. And now these are the most prominent way, perhaps, that we see the emphasis on fulfillment of the Old Testament in Matthew. It's not all that Matthew has to say about fulfillment, but they're the most obvious, perhaps. So there are 10 of these citations. They're different counts, but from different scholars. I would see there to be 10 of them. And half of them, I believe, come in the first four chapters. And then the rest of Matthew, you know, the other 24 chapters contain the other five. And so they're heavy at the beginning, especially as we begin to meet Jesus as a child. So in the infancy narrative, there are many of them. And they come from all over. They come from Isaiah. They come from Jeremiah. They come from Hosea. They come even from the Psalms, which are called prophetic. So they don't just come from one or two Old Testament passages, but they come from all over. And there's a lot of debate around them, because some of the most debated passages in terms of Matthew's use of the Old Testament are often wrapped up with these fulfillment formula quotations, as they are called. So you mentioned Matthew 2:23, he will be called a Nazarene. There's also perhaps the one that gets discussed most often, which is the virgin will conceive and bear a son, and from Isaiah 7:14. And another one that's discussed a lot is Hosea 11:1 and Matthew 2:15, out of Egypt I have called my son. And so discussions range from how is he using the Old Testament? Is he taking them out of context? Does he view all of the Old Testament as predictive? Some of these don't appear to be predictive. What is his hermeneutical approach here? And so there are a number of questions we could ask from these citations. In the article, I'm not able to answer all of the questions about them. Instead, what I look to do is to find a shared thematic coherence among these. And what I'm arguing is, you have a contextual reading of the Old Testament, and in these Old Testament passages, Matthew is finding negative passages about the waywardness or the sinfulness of Israel, and then applying them to Jesus, often in terms of his sonship, and showing that he is overcoming them by his full-fledged obedience. That's in a nutshell the argument that I'm trying to make in this article.
Mm-hmm. So Jesus then has a particular relationship not only to the nation of Israel, but that as Matthew presents him as sort of the consummate fulfillment of the Old Testament scriptures. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So so the angle I'm coming at here is particularly an Israel angle. And now I've argued elsewhere that there's Adam imagery there in Matthew as well, but clearly there's Israel imagery for Jesus and Matthew. And so the nuance I want to try to highlight and argue for is that the shape of Israel was in many ways sinful, but should not have been. And Jesus is showing what a true Israelite ought to be, and indeed overcoming their sinfulness through his full-fledged obedience.
Mm-hmm. So it's important then to step back, I think, at least for me, when we're thinking of fulfillment in Matthew and think about the use of that word fulfillment. It's an important word, and especially when we think about Matthew's use of pleroo and the Greek word there. Often when we think, at least with English and with prophets, when we think of something being fulfilled, we think of like foretelling. Like there's going to be a description of something that will happen in the future. It hasn't happened yet, but the prophet speaks of it happening in the future. And then Jesus, it happens to him in his life, and there it's fulfilled. But Matthew seems to have a broader, not necessarily different or competitive, but a much broader idea of what a fulfillment might be, doesn't he?
He does, that's right. And that's why part of the reason I think that you have so much discussion about these, because a classic example here is the use of Hosea 11:1 in Matthew 2:15, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." Now, is Matthew viewing that as predictive? This is a question many ask, because if you read Hosea, it's in many ways a reflection on the past event of the Exodus. And so the accusation has often been lobbed at Matthew that he simply does not understand the Old Testament at this point.
Right, right.
Which I think is a very weak argument, mm-hmm. because if you keep reading Hosea 11, he is forward-looking. And that's maybe a helpful category to keep in mind. There are different types of genres within the prophetic corpus, different forms, even if you want to use that term, understood rightly. And so what you have then are different ways that the prophets write. But even if it's not a prophetic text that is just simple, if I can put it this way, simple prediction looking forward to fulfillment, the prophets are eschatologically charged, and they are looking forward to the consummation of the promises and the covenantal blessings and things like this. And so it would be, I think, a bit simplistic to say there's got to be a simple prediction type of text for it to be used that way in the New Testament. As the New Testament writers make clear, they're often drawing from texts of the prophets and elsewhere in a variety of different types of contexts, mm-hmm. in the prophets. And they are consistent with the scope of what is intended there, which is to say that there's a forward-looking of hope that the prophets and the Psalms and things like this have. For example, in Acts, David is identified as a prophet in the Psalms, and the Psalms are used that way in Acts. And so in Matthew, very similarly, what you have is the understanding that the prophets are looking forward to the consummation of the covenantal promises, for example. And that runs all throughout the prophets because they are eschatologically focused. They often are indeed anticipating a future act of God, even if we might not call it a simple prediction.
Sure, sure. Like with predictions, for example, just so the listeners can follow, you know, something about Micah 5, I believe, you know, which talks about the Messiah being born in Bethlehem, and it's easy enough for us to understand, well, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, there, you know, prophecy, prediction, fulfillment. But even there, there's a lot more going on. And as we broaden our context to all the ways in which Matthew speaks about Jesus as fulfilling the Old Testament, we see that there's great depth and a lot of contour here. One thing that you say right even in the title of the article, Fulfillment in Matthew is Eschatological Reversal, you're describing here how Jesus relates to Israel and how he is the greater Israel, but you're really focusing in on a specific idea that he is providing this fulfillment by a reversal, that he is succeeding where Israel has failed. Can you describe that further? How does Jesus fulfill the Old Testament by reversing the failures of the nation?
So it's see if I can do it simply. What you have are the texts from the Old Testament that Matthew is drawing from. They are consistently texts in which Israel is being rebuked for their unfaithfulness in particular ways. And so one example is Jeremiah 31 that's used in Matthew 2 as well, where you have Rachel weeping for her children. Now, that's another one of the most difficult of right. all the passages.
It's
what
very
does that
confusing.
Mean? Yes. And I have not perhaps answered every question about that, but what I'm saying about that particular text goes something like this. That is a positive text about the new covenant, and that God is going to intervene. He's going to revisit his people. He's going to bring them a new covenant, and he will not cast off his sons, and he will remember his promises. This is the sort of idea that you have going on in Jeremiah 31. But you also have stuck in the middle of that, Jeremiah 31, I believe it's verse 18, isn't it, where he says that it's Rachel weeping for her children. Now, whatever that means, everyone basically agrees that has something to do with that exile, that Ramah is going to be the place where the exile, they met to march out to the exile, something right. like this. And Rachel is not actually alive at this point.
Mm-hmm.
She's a type, or she's a matriarchal figure for the mother of Israel who is weeping. She was buried in that area. She's weeping for her children who are not experiencing the covenantal blessings, but are now experiencing, in fact, the covenantal curses by being marched out of the promised land and paying, in a sense, for their sins. And so what you have then is a reminder in that text of the waywardness of Israel. And even if you view the coming new covenant as a positive thing, the fact is they needed a new covenant because the other one had been broken. And so that's one way to look at it. Another way, let me mention this one briefly, is Hosea 11 in Matthew 2, out of Egypt I've called my son. Well, the problem, if you keep reading, is the Lord says he loved Israel, he taught them to walk, he fed them, he guided them, and they continued to rebel against him. And yet one day, if you keep reading around verses 10 or 11 in Hosea 11, in the future they will hear his voice, in the future he will come out, and there will be a new and greater exodus that comes. Because even though God had delivered his people, even though he had cared for them tenderly as a father, they had continued to rebel against him. And so whereas Israel in the past had not been faithful to their calling as son of God, you're going to have a more faithful son who comes along and is going to obey the voice of the Lord. And you see this also not in a fulfillment passage, but just think of the temptation account of Jesus, where everyone agrees there is Israel imagery there as son of God. And Jesus is quoting from texts like Deuteronomy 6, Deuteronomy 8, and showing what an obedient son ought to be in a way that recalls largely the context of Israel. And where they failed in the wilderness, Jesus will succeed in the wilderness. Even, for example, in the eating of bread, where Israel failed, Jesus will succeed. And so in that sense, he's overcoming the waywardness of Israel and being a true, faithful Israelite.
Mm-hmm. If I could ask a question, maybe we could camp out a little bit on Hosea 11:1, yeah. Quoted in Matthew 2. Dr. Beal oftentimes will talk about the peripheral vision, and it's been a while since I've listened to his lecture and read his stuff on it. But does that kind of fall within the basic contours of what you're getting at here, that for instance, as Matthew quotes Hosea 11:1, he doesn't have in view just Hosea 11:1 narrowly, but there is within his peripheral vision, or perhaps we might even say behind 11:1 is a broader eschatological vision and understanding, and maybe we might even say hermeneutic of the prophetic literature. That informs his use of Hosea 11:1.
Yeah, I think that's certainly very much in line with what I'm saying. Dr. Beal's term is a lot better than mine. What's the cognitive peripheral vision, which means he understands the context. I don't want to oversimplify what Dr. Beal is saying, but that's more or less what it means, that when he's looking at one passage or one issue, he's aware of other things as well. And I think that's certainly the case. This is a debated area of New Testament studies. To what degree are the New Testament writers aware and consistent with the Old Testament context? And you will still get different answers to this question. But there is a strong stream of scholarship today that says, you know what, they are, in almost every case, you can show that typically the New Testament writers are aware of the context. And so it depends on who you're reading, but there that is widespread now in scholarship. And so it's not a difficult position to hold because so many are aware that that's probably the case. Richard Hayes even recently in what he's writing is arguing more or less for that in the gospel, his book on Echoes of Scripture in the Gospels. And so he goes back to C.H. Dodd, who says that there are passages in the Old Testament that were particularly well known because we see the same passages being quoted over and over again in different contexts and different parts of those passages. That's a foundational work for many people. And that's a short little book of about 120 pages, I think, C.H. Dodd, According to the Scriptures. And so Dr. Beal has argued this. I'm in agreement there. And I think what you do have in Matthew is, at the very least, we give him the benefit of the doubt. And I think this is just good hermeneutical practice. Whenever you're reading anything, you give the author the benefit of the doubt that they know what they're doing. And certainly when it comes to biblical writers, we give them the benefit of the doubt. And when we do that, we begin to see that it's not difficult to say that they are having the Old Testament context in view because it makes sense. It makes sense if you have a more robust understanding, as you say, of the way the prophetic literature works. But it would be astounding to me to think that we today have a better understanding of the Old Testament than biblical authors.
Right.
So for an example, you will still hear people say that Matthew misunderstands the quote, the use of Zechariah 9:9 about the riding on two donkeys or two horses or two colts at the same time. And commentators will even just miss it as, oh, that's absurd. What did he think he was doing? He was trying to show how this was literally fulfilled. But perhaps we could say we don't have to assume Matthew was absurd. There are ways around it. Was he sitting on two coats, for example? But it makes a lot of sense for there to be, you know, for example, a mother and a daughter or a child there, for example, in terms of the horse and the colt, the foal. We should not simply assume that the biblical writers, and Matthew in particular, do not understand the context. This was a more popular position to have probably 40 years ago or so. Now, if you're going to have that view, you actually really have to argue for it, I think, because there's so much fellowship saying they are aware of the context. And Hosea 11 is a good example because that one verse is not all that's in view there. What you have is the entire passage. And another question about Hosea 11:1 is why is it put here in verse 15 before he comes out of Egypt? Because it says, out of Egypt I've called my son. Some will say, well, he's just gone into Egypt. Why do you have coming out of Egypt here? Well, part of the reason may be the forward-looking nature of Hosea 11:1. That's looking forward to Hosea verses 11, 10, and 11, where there is going to be a new Exodus coming out of Egypt. And so it's already, even in the way Matthew uses it, perhaps we could argue that he is anticipating this greater work of salvation, even in the movement of Jesus to Egypt, in light of the context of Hosea 11.
It's also, in a sense, kind of backwards, too, because the way that he fulfills that greater Exodus is he escapes danger by going into Egypt, which you mentioned as well there, which itself is kind of a reversal if you back up to look at the Moses story on how Moses escaped the same type of plight where Pharaoh had ordered the death of all the Israelite or the Hebrew baby, male children. Jesus, undergoing a similar decree from Herod, escapes that plight not within Egypt, but by going to Egypt. It's very, very different there. So he's also doing kind of a reversal in that sense as well.
Exactly. So you have, certainly you have Moses imagery there and typology in Matthew. I don't get into that in the article. But part of that is you have fleeing from Jerusalem to Egypt for safety instead of fleeing from Egypt, you know, to the promised land. He's having to flee the what I call a squatter king, King Herod the Great, who presents himself as God's king, but he's really, you know, he's a poser. He's not a righteous king at all.
I remember a friend of mine saying to me one time when discussing this passage, particularly the use of Hosea and Matthew, and I think the question went something like this very eloquently. what was Matthew smoking when he decided to quote Hosea like that? And I think that that points up maybe a problem, not maybe, most definitely a problem with the way that we can sometimes approach biblical literature or any literature for that matter, but almost in a, I don't know, kind of a micro atomistic, maybe even pedantic way, where we demand of the writers of scripture a kind of standard that we ourselves have imposed upon the way in which we do, let's say, research today, or we do research writing, where everything has to be fully spelled out and footnoted and documented, et cetera. You're not allowed to leave anything in the world of academic scholarship, a kind of left presupposed in the background. You have to lay it all out nice and neat. And that's just not the way that ancient writers wrote. That's and not the way that the biblical writers in this instance wrote. And I think that this is kind of where the big problem arises with hermeneutics, is kind of with an abstract notion that ends up getting applied to scripture and becomes the critical arbiter by which we judge the scriptures. And when we approach the scriptures in that way, it seems as if that the scriptures have no other choice other than to lose to our particular rigid and albeit abstract standards.
Yeah, I think you're making some good points there. And let me just build on that and say, you know, they weren't using Bible Works or Accordance or Logos to do word searches, you know, and to find isolated text. We're so used to thinking of this verse or that verse. They didn't have that.
They didn't verse numbers.
So whenever he's looking at Hosea 11, This is part of Hosea 11. They weren't thinking as atomistically, I don't think, about this verse. They're thinking about passages, typically. They're thinking about sections of scripture and speeches or a particular prophetic movement. And so, you know, the passage about the bush, for example, as you have saying in the New Testament. So I think that is that's one thing to think about. The other thing is some of the best, most literary, most poetic writing is quite elusive, and it is it's bringing in a lot of context of things, and those who have eyes to see and ears to hear can pick them up. And so I was working with some high school students recently and showing them Lincoln's second inaugural address, for example. Some say one of the greatest speeches in American history. And in fact, biblical scholar Dale Allison actually has a section on Lincoln's second inaugural in one of his books on Q because of how elusive it is, where Lincoln doesn't spell out what he's using. But if you begin to study and learn the language, you know, he's pulling from biblical language. He's pulling from a number of places. Even 67 years ago, that is Psalm 90 from some of the older translations. And so there is a sense in which Matthew is being quite explicit in these fulfillment quotations, where he is saying, this fulfills the prophet. But also you have levels of depth there that those with, as we might say, with the eyes to see and ears to hear, can hear it. R.T. France is a Matthean scholar. The late R.T. France has an article called Matthew 2 and the Problem of Communication. It's probably quoted somewhere in the article, where he says that you have these different levels of significance, meaning Matthew is able to communicate at a great depth to those who understand the context of these passages. But for those who don't know them, they can still get the basic picture. And I think that is indeed what we have here. And if you know the context, then you start to say, wait a minute, this actually makes perfect sense. But not just from reading one verse. It's from looking at what's going on in the prophets a little more in an integrated fashion.
It can be difficult enough when we can identify a specific reference in the Old Testament where there's actually a literal quotation from a passage that we have identified. But then when we come to the third fulfillment text, which you mentioned here in Matthew 2:23, it gets even more complicated. The verse reads, and he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled, that he would be called a Nazarene. Well, the issue is, to our knowledge, there is no such verse that says exactly that. I mean, literally, that appears to be a quotation. It isn't. He's referencing the Old Testament, but what's going on here, how is Matthew speaking of, where does he derive this notion that the prophet said he would be called a Nazarene?
That's the million-dollar question, or maybe not worth that much in biblical studies. $35 question. And there are a number of, not surprisingly, a number of options there.
Sure.
Is that it's like a Nazarite. Think of the transliteration Nazarene, Nazarite, something like Samson. That's possible. Certainly, Samson is a type of the Messiah to come.
Mm.
So that's possible, but probably the more popular option is to look at the prophets, plural there, and to see that this is more than just one passage, but it says the generic introductory formula might actually be a tip-off here. He says in verse 23, I should say, prophets, plural. And it doesn't say which prophet or prophets, but it's simply the plural prophet. So that may be one sign. And Hebrew, you have the Davidic branch or shoot, the Netzer. And so you have a word that looks like Nazarene, and you also have and these are passages like Isaiah 11:1. Isaiah 11 is clearly a messianic type of text.
Yeah.
This is often combined with the branch idea, but you also have some argue that he will be called. The calling is actually a pejorative type accusatory type of call. It's a ridiculing of him. It's a downplaying of him. And so you have Nazareth as a place that you would not expect anything good to come from Nazareth, as you see in John 1. But you also have this lends itself well to understanding Jesus as the branch of David from Nazareth. There's really not a perfect answer to this question. I don't think any answer dots all the I's and crosses all the T's. But I think the best answer is this theme of the prophets of a rejected Messiah, perhaps, but also the Netzer idea, the branch, the shoot of David, the stump, something like that.
Sure, and that brings up this idea, certainly, that Jesus would be not only the fulfillment here of the Old Testament, but along the theme of eschatological reversal that we've been speaking, that he is the rejected Messiah. Not an accepted one or one who was well-received, but leaning upon Isaiah 53, for example, which you reference in the article, that he is a suffering servant, and he's despised and rejected of men. You know, he had no appearance that we would, give him honor or glory of anything of the sort, but rather he would be bruised and by his wounds we would be healed. So that definitely shows how Jesus fulfills this role, but it's not in some sort of glorious way, at least during his humiliation.
Yeah, and so you have Isaiah 53 used for the healing ministry of Jesus actually there in Matthew 8. You also have the Isaiah 42 text. This is the longest of the quotation passages, of the fulfillment passages in Matthew 12, the servant. He will not raise his voice or cry out in the streets. You know, smoldering wick he will not extinguish. That's that long passage there. But it's a surprising figure there in Isaiah 42 who will not clamor, who will not raise his voice, who's something like a humility here of this figure, and yet he's going to be this great leader. And that's set in contrast to the Pharisees in the context of Matthew 12. I believe it's bracketed on either side by the clamoring, we could say, of the Pharisees. So it's at least a surprising figure there, the Isaiah 53 and Isaiah 42. Both of those texts are used by Matthew. And the fact that he has to suffer also points to the rejection of, even by his own people, which is the great irony of the Gospels, is that the Messiah, who really is the Messiah, is actually rejected by his people. And then irony upon irony is by that rejection that he's actually established as the Messianic King. And that the great reversal, of course, comes in the resurrection. But you have here this figure that no one would have expected, just historically. They didn't expect it to look like this. But Matthew is saying, this is scriptural. This is there. As we say, contextual readings of the Old Testament make it clear, this is not an unforeseen novum. This is something that they should have understood. But by and large, he was rejected, which is the great tragic irony of the Gospels.
Yeah, it is. These are some well-known and oft-treated references in Matthew 2, but what are some other likely reversal texts that we find throughout the Gospel?
Right, so we have the ones in Matthew 2 we've talked about at some length. We also have, I think, one of the strongest ones, and let me just start here, Psalm 78. What's interesting, this is a psalm of Asaph, but it's clearly viewed by Matthew as prophetic. Psalm 78, some Presbyterian churches may open with that. I know one church I used to go to, every time there was a baptism, they opened with the first four verses, I believe it is, of Psalm 78, about passing these things down to your children. But that those verses actually also say that they may not be like your fathers, a rebellious generation or a rebellious people who do not listen to God. So it's an urge to pass these things down, but also a critique and a warning against those who so often were disobedient. And then Psalm 78 goes on forever. It's a long psalm. It goes on at length about the rebelliousness and the waywardness of Israel, and about it's a contrast between God's faithfulness and his mighty deeds and the people's consistent rebellion. It reminds you perhaps of a text like Deuteronomy 32 and Moses' swan song there in the Song of Moses. But what you have in Psalm 78 is Jesus simply says, I will open my mouth in a parable, and this explains his teaching in parables. But what you have with the parables of Jesus is this double-sidedness. You know, if you know your Ritterboss, you know some of the redemptive historical ways of reading the parables, they're more than just analogies or illustrations. You know, they do that. But what they are prophetic speech that is double-sided. And so you have, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, it's a great blessing and means of revelation. For those who are hard-hearted, it occludes and it leads to judgment. And the explanation for the parabolic ministry of Jesus comes from Psalm 78. And so just as the parables of Jesus were this prophetic speech and it had his double-sidedness and this warning aspect to them, Psalm 78 recounts the history of Israel. And by Jesus opening his mouth in a parable, if you know Psalm 78, and again, Matthew would have known Psalm 78, it is a psalm about the recalcitrance and the sinfulness of Israel. And yet what you have in the use of Psalm 78 in Matthew is, D.A. Carson, I quote him in the article, I believe, he captures it well. What you have here is the bringing out of what may not have been evident to all the readers, but there is it's a making known of things that lie hidden apart from the revelation of God. And part of that is the warning against those who are hardening their hearts against God. And part of that is the way that all of the hopes of Israel are coming to a head in Jesus as well. The parables are, in some way, Christological, pointing to Jesus and his work. And so those with eyes to see and ears to hear are not only seeing the message of this or that parable, but they're understanding the message of Jesus and the kingdom of God as a whole and the way that he is bringing deliverance for his people. There's more to say on that, and I maybe commend that section for the listeners that are interested to see. I think I say maybe more about Psalm 78 than any other.
It's just so counterintuitive, I think, to so much of our hermeneutic that we somehow kind of breathe in naturally until such a time as it's corrected, which is to say that here you have the New Testament and this is the New Testament. All right, very good. It's about Jesus. And then you got the Old Testament and that's about Israel. And to understand that the New Testament list than the Old really is about Israel, and it's about Christ, who is the new Israel that comes and reverses everything that Israel before him represented in its disobedience and its rebellion against God and its breaking of the covenant. I'm starting to preach through Hosea now, and I'm starting to see that theme there in Hosea, and the way in which Hosea is condemning Israel. And it makes perfect sense by the time that you come to the New Testament that Israel, who is at one time not a people, who were a people and then declared not a people, and then receive the promise that they will be the people of God, how that ends up getting fulfilled, that prophecy, how God's people made up of both Jew and Gentile are going to be his people, and the way in which Paul uses that in Romans chapter 9, for instance, and we can go all day on this as well. What about, you had indicated a little bit Brandon, before about Adam. And I know that your focus here is not necessarily on Adam, but would you be able to just maybe comment a little bit about the relationship as you see it between Adam and Israel and the way in which Christ fulfills and reverses the curse that is pronounced on both of them?
Yeah, I'll do my best. Certainly they're complementary, Adam and Israel. When you're dealing with Matthew, it's a much easier case to make because it's much more on the surface and not debated, really, that Jesus is presented in Matthew as the fulfillment of Israel and as the answer even to Israel's disobedience. That's not all that uncommon. What's harder to make the case for is Adam, because there are no verses that says Jesus is like Adam, like you have in Luke 3:38, for example. And so when you're dealing with the question of overcoming Israel's disobedience, I think it is here in the fulfillment text, and that what you have is a consistent presentation of Jesus fulfilling the scriptures in contrast to Israel, who did not fulfill their calling to be covenantally faithful sons of God. So that is the primary relief that Jesus is set in contrast to in Matthew. And so it's there. The question that I was asking, if you're alluding to the book I wrote, The Last Adam, that we did an interview on here about that.
Yeah, that's great.
The question I'm asking in that book is, what is ultimate here? How is Jesus accomplishing salvation? If Israel is not the beginning of the story, it's not that it's an either or, he fulfills Israel or Adam. He must fulfill Israel because Matthew presents it that way. But ultimately, if he is accomplishing salvation, do we see that this is also presented in some sense in Adamic terms? And it's there clearly in Mark, as I argue, and the temptation account. It's there in Luke to some degree because he mentions Jesus in the genealogy. I think it's there in John. But maybe it's not that common in scholarship to see it in Matthew. Now, Dr. Beal has a nice section in his New Testament Biblical Theology on this in the beginning of Matthew, for example, begins the book of the genealogy of Jesus, which is the same word for Genesis. So you could say the new book of Genesis of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. But once you start to see what is there in Israel, that's not all there is. And what you begin to do, what I try to do in the Adam book, is to bring a lot of pieces together to say, ultimately, if Jesus is accomplishing salvation, he has to be doing ultimately what Adam was not able to do, because Jesus must be presented not just as an Israelite, but as one who is, if I could put it this way, greater than the Israelites, because he's not born like an Israelite. He is born specially by the Holy Spirit from the Virgin Mary. And so he is, yes, of Israel, but there's a sense in which he is apart from Israel because he's not born under this curse of Israel, the curse of Adam, as we could say. And so what you have then are these two complementary streams that I'm trying to bring some coherence to in the Adam book. So in this paper, in this essay, I'm not getting into that question as much of things like imputation. But what I am getting into is, which believe it or not, I do get into in the Adam book on the Gospels.
Sure.
But what I'm looking at is, how is Jesus presented in contrast to Israel? And he is obedient at every turn. And he's even overcoming the sin of Israel at every turn. Now, if you know authors like Irenaeus, he presents Jesus overcoming the sin of Adam and recapitulating Adam. But we can also say he's recapitulating in Matthew Israel. And so he is overcoming Israel. But at the end of the day, I think that leaves us one step short of explaining the logic of how he accomplishes salvation, because all Israelites were in Adam. And so to really have the fullest explanation of that, I think you have to keep teasing it out and keep digging down and then begin to look at the Adamic dimensions that Paul, for example, makes more explicit, but which I argue are also there in the Gospels. And just one more comment. The argument that Jesus is fulfilling Israel, that's relatively uncontroversial. My argument about Adam, that would be a lot more disputed. I've done the best that I could do to make the case for that, and I do think it's there. But what I'm arguing for in this article, it's not said this way by anyone else that I know, but the concept that Jesus is overcoming Israel, that much is relatively uncontroversial.
Yeah.
But
it's very helpful. And I would refer our listeners to our previous episode and interview with Brandon on his book, The Last Adam, A Theology of the Obedient Life of Jesus in the Gospel. Years prior to that, we also spoke about his dissertation, which has also been published, The Obedient Son, Deuteronomy and Christology in the Gospel of Matthew. So there's plenty material there for those of you who would like to dive deeper. And, of course, we refer you to download the PDF and read this particular article, Fulfillment in Matthew as Eschatological Reversal. It's in Westminster Theological Journal, number 75, back in 2013. On pages 111 through 127. It's been fascinating, Brandon. Again, it's very helpful. Always love speaking with you and getting a good solid dose of New Testament exegesis and biblical theology. We really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us today, Brandon.
Well, I'm happy to be here and get a chance to discuss it. And so I hope your listeners find it helpful, and I hope you all find it helpful.
Oh, sure. You bet.
Indeed.
I would also encourage everybody to visit faculty.wts.edu. You can find information about Westminster Theological Seminary faculty. Brandon has a profile there, as well as lists and images of his books, several books, The Essential Trinity, The Last Adam, The Message of the General Epistles, and The History of Redemption. We've spoken about them all on Reformed Forum and this program, Christ the Center. You can find lectures, courses, articles, posts, you name it. faculty.wts.edu. You can find information about us online as well as all of our programs, including our newest, Theology Simply Profound, available at reformedforum.org. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.